Radio.
The Bible and the Mystery of Self-Deception. A series of talks by Dr. Robert Tilley at the Catholic Institute of Sydney, held in May 2012. The topic of this third and final talk is The Bible and Self-Analysis, Mystical Humility and Identifying the Signs of Self-Deception.
St. Teresa, in her work, The Interior Castle, writes this: in speaking of the soul, we must always think of it as spacious, ample and lofty. And this can be done without the least exaggeration, for the soul's capacity is much greater than we can realize. In speaking of the soul, we must always think of it as spacious, ample and lofty. And this can be done without the least exaggeration, for the soul's capacity is much greater than we can realize. In other words, there's an expansiveness to the soul, or at least there should be, but unfortunately many of us feel almost a claustrophobic sense of ourselves, a sense in which we almost want to escape ourselves, and to that I'll return later. Why is it that we do not realize the greatness of our soul? Pride, of course. A corruption of ourselves by ourselves. And through humility, which we've spoken of, which is a true self-knowledge, we find our true nature. As St. Teresa said, nothing matters more to us than humility. For through it we can come to understand, she goes on to say, the very fact that His Majesty says that the soul is made in His image. And this means that we can hardly form any conception of the soul's great dignity and beauty. It is no small pity, and should cause us no little shame, that through our own fault we do not understand ourselves or know who we are. And I think that's been especially compounded in the contemporary world, especially, well, by reason of the so-called dominance of the inner journey. Because I do not think it an inner journey at all, for reasons that will become clear. The problem today is that there's been almost for 80 years, well, at least 80 years, in fact it began in the 19th century with what was called then New Thought, but certainly since the likes of Norman Vincent Peale, probably a number of you are too young to actually know who he was, or Dale Carnegie, the whole idea of positive thinking, of accenting a sense of self-esteem. And for 50 years at least, this has been tied to an idea of an inner journey. Many even use St. Teresa. But as I noted in the first week, they might use St. Teresa or St. John of the Cross or Walter Hilton or others, but they'll do it without the same accent on a radical self-critique. Rather, all of these books, all of them, have an accent on pleasure, on what is pleasurable, on what is self-affirming, on ideas of self-affirming experience, becoming materially, psychologically, and of course sexually successful. All of these self-help books, these pop psychology books, indeed these so-called spiritual books, these New Age books, all of them have to do with an inner journey that is somehow radically different from those who actually first charted the inner journey, namely the saints. Why is this? And what explains it? And I think in a short sentence it's this: there is no fear. There is no fear. In the Bible there can be discerned a paradigmatic way of progress of a soul. And I think it goes like this. In Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And then in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And yet, in John 1 John 4:18, finally perfect love casts out all fear. And then in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12, and then shall I know, even as fully I am known. So there's a kind of paradigmatic path in the Bible that begins with the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And yet, finally, where you come to is that perfect love drives out all fear. For then shall I know fully as even I am fully known. But this is the point. Fear is clearly not the end or the goal, but it certainly is very much the means. And if you do not fear, then there's something wrong. Who is it that we fear? Well, as the saints and mystics pointed out, who we're to fear and what we're to fear is first we're to learn to fear our own deceit. For all told, we are our own worst enemy. And we look to bolster ourselves through self-esteem as if it were self-empowerment, and that's through the contemporary inner journey, with the aim of becoming strong, successful, and ultimately not dependent on others. Not dependent on others. The whole contemporary, the whole modern journey is exactly about that, is about getting an autonomy so powerful, so self-referential, that you do not have to depend upon others. And indeed, you start to feel a contempt for others who depend on others. Indeed, it seemed to be almost like a disease, a kind of correlational disease, to actually depend on others. And I guess this is writ large in things like euthanasia. The idea, I want to die in dignity, meaning I don't want to die in dependence on others. I want to die as I choose, in a kind of last gasp of autonomy. So we do the inner journey and it's promoted and we're pumped as if we will become powerful as the world counts power. Well, that is really at the basis of self-deception. And that's why I said in the first class that self-deception is not just a so-called individual thing. It has very strong political, cultural, and yes, economic facets to it. And so it is in the modern contemporary inner journey, we enter in so quickly and we feel so strong, so easily, so immediately, and we feel such bliss so easily, and we even see inner light so easily. And this inner light, we feel, guides us pleasantly so that we will become strong and self-empowered and full of its self-esteem. In saying all this, I do not think I am caricaturing the modern spiritual inner journey at all. In fact, I am underplaying it. And I should say, up until probably the last 5 or 10 years, I read most of the major works in terms of the inner journey and popular pop psychology and spirituality, and regularly attended, out of an interest and research, many of the major do's, such as Mind Body Spirit Festival, but a host of others as well. I do not think I am caricaturing it at all. And yet, this is so fundamentally different to what the fathers of the church, to what the Bible, to what the mystics wrote, and indeed, fundamentally different to, in fact, what we find in just about all religions. And yet we, with our pop consumerism and our eclecticism, seem to know better. But hear what the mystics say. Walter Hilton, the 14th century Augustinian monk, said that if we truly enter in, what we will experience is something like this. This is how he describes it. It will be like, quote, a house full of smoke and a chiding wife, a nagging wife, or, if, to be fair, a cantankerous husband. In other words, we will want to get out as soon as possible. And thus Walter Hilton writes, what is it that is hindering you from seeking God? Truly there is so much din and racket in your heart of vain thoughts and carnal desires that you cannot either hear or see God. I find it again interesting how religions like Buddhism are appropriated in our modern Western world. You'll often hear, I'm a Buddhist, I can believe and do anything, which is of course an incredible travesty. But one of the major tenets of Eastern religion, of course, is the recognition of what is called our monkey mind. The fact that our mind will always jump around erratically and that this is informed by our carnal desires. And yet, that doesn't seem to have much preeminence again in contemporary modern inner journey. Worse still, what Walter Hilton wrote about was the inner journey that thinks that it sees the light, but sees instead a counterfeit light, something I touched upon last week with St. John's point about the darkness not comprehending the light. A counterfeit light that is accompanied by, quote, this is Walter Hilton, presumption, self-promotion, and the disdain of one's fellow Christians. Now, of course, many of these writers were writing to those in orders or congregations, but I think it applies to all of us. And the major point that they would always say is that what you would find with certain of those in orders and congregations were that you would always get someone who had claimed that they had this mystical exaltation. They had heard, indeed, the song of angels, and consequently, that seemed to give them license then to start to see all their fellows or their sisters as being not quite up to it. And how many times do you hear Catholics saying of other Catholics, they're Sunday Catholics? How do you know? What gives you the right to say that? First of all, is that the soul needs, quote, to be struck down from its height of self-elevation by the fear of God. The soul needs to be struck down from the height of self-elevation by the fear of God. And thus Walter Hilton writes, I believe that a soul that has truly recognized its own murkiness, is not vulnerable to a counterfeit light. Or as St. Teresa put it, the soul must, quote, retain 1,000 suspicions of itself. The soul must retain 1,000 suspicions. For we so easily deceive ourselves. Now we need to note something here, something else very, very important. If you are to be suspicious of a lie, you need to know what the truth is, or at least have an intimation of the truth. But if you feel there is no absolute truth, then what is a lie? If there is no absolute truth, then what is a lie? If there is no true self, then there can be no false self. For the only truth that we will have if there is no objective truth is that everything is malleable. All is relative, and it means everything is plastic. And this certainly describes our hyper-consumer world. A world that has made a fortune from selling self-esteem and the inner journey. Now you'll have to excuse me a little bit because I'm going to have to inform you a little bit on the background of certain philosophical themes that are very much part of modern contemporary cultural themes. I made a mention of it very briefly, I think, in the first week, and it's called in philosophy the crisis of the subject. It has to do with the idea of whether or not there is a nature proper to the self. Is there a true self? Or are we merely infinitely malleable? A lot of this gets discussed by questions of what is essentialism, and not wanting here to get into any debate as to gay marriage or anything, I think it does illustrate well what has occurred in the last 20 or so years. And having raised that, I might give an example of Germaine Greer. In Germaine Greer's college at Cambridge, it's an all-women's college. And I think in the early 90s, what happened was that a transsexual, a man who had become a woman after an operation, wanted to become a member. Germaine Greer said, no, you're still a man. Just because you've had your genitals lopped off does not make you a woman. Many people opposed that. And one of the reasons for this was because in the 1980s especially, the issue of whether or not there was something essential to human nature became very dominant. And the idea was that not even sex, not even gender, that's a literary, a grammatical term, but not even sex or gender is essential, that everything can change. And that's been the major issue. In the early 90s, there was a group called Queer Nation, which was a very radical gay group, that argued there is no sexuality essentially so, that you can be gay one day, straight the next, bi the next, and so on and so forth. And they were opposed a lot by the more mainstream gay establishment. It's a dead debate that still goes on today. But the point is this. The argument turns on whether or not there is an essential nature to being human, to the self. And under capitalist consumerism, more and more it's dominant that no, there is not. And in fact, the last 10 to 20 years in the pop psychology books, the accent has been on the idea that you can be anything you want, and even the idea of you, well, that's just a little bit of an illusion. You may think that this is rather airy-fairy and this is what you'd expect of critical theory in universities, but believe me, it is something incredibly widespread. There is no fixed self, but a kind of eternally malleable nature, the truth of which is you can become anything you want to be. A freedom from solidity, a freedom from definiteness, a freedom from stability or identity. For all is polymorphous, all is fluid, all is eclectic, all is transgressive, all is unlimited, pluralistic, indefinite, fast, speedy, pumping, thrilling, and full of so-called endless opportunity. Such is the flattery, such are the promises. The interesting thing is that that language is a language of contemporary consumer theory. It's also the language that was very big in the 80s and 90s in so-called postmodern philosophy. And it's also the language in a lot of theology today, so-called spirituality, literary studies. But above all, it's a language of big, big business. And I would actually suggest you start to look at the theories promoted once by Steve Jobs, now by Bill Gates, and indeed throughout Silicon Valley, and indeed in all the major big business firms. That is the language. It is a championing, I guess, of neoliberal free market consumer economics. But the interesting thing is here. When scholars have studied the history of self-esteem, when they've studied the history of those contemporary inner journey books, the idea that you can be anything books, you know what they have found? You know what they have found through all these books? What they have found is this. All of them are oriented to getting you to meet the demands of business and the market. They all use the language of market and business, and though they say you can be whatever it is you wish to be, strangely enough, all these books recommend that you be successful, such that you will be successful for business. And indeed, many more contemporary books now talk about you becoming your own brand. Your own brand. In other words, in the absence of objective truth, in a relativistic world, the market and pragmatism provide the criteria for what you ought to be. And as the market ever changes, so too must you. Just as a product must sell itself as the bestest ever thing that is full of promise and blessings, so too must you. You must sell yourself. Believe in yourself as your own brand. Pump yourself up in your own eyes so you believe you are the greatest brand. But when you think about it, how different that is to what the mystics argued about the inner journey. How different that is to the idea of combating, first and foremost, pride as self-deception. In other words, we do introject, the opposite of project. We introject the values of our culture, for good or for bad. And consequently, inciting self-deception, you must know your culture. You must know your culture. You must know what is valued, what is thought to be successful in your culture. And what you must do is write those things down and then tally them up and then see to what degree you shape yourself to that. We live in a double world, as in any ideology, there is a doubleness of which I discussed before. And perhaps one of the major areas of doubleness in our contemporary consumer culture is the idea that pumps you up as being everyone is valuable. But in point of fact, the doubleness of our culture says otherwise. For, of course, in our nation alone, there are something like 80,000 unborn killed per year. So in other words, not all life is valuable in our culture, yet it pretends it to be so. We live, as John Paul II said, in a culture of death, and yet it pretends to be a culture of life. Life itself has become defined as a commodity to be researched upon, marketed, or disposed of. And though we try to hide this fact from ourselves, nevertheless, all of us here know to the degree in which there is a doubleness. One of the interesting points I always found in the refinding of Karl Marx. Marx may have been a little bit awry in his prophecies and certainly his gross materialism, I think, rather led him astray. But Marx had an incredible lot of insight into the growth of consumer culture and industrialism. And one of Marx's major points, first, as it were, adumbrated in the Communist Manifesto, but later in his life, spelt out in Das Kapital, was about the commodification of value, which is to say, that things no longer have an intrinsic value, but they have a commodity value, a consumer value. But here's the strange thing, that in the last 10 years with the global financial crisis, lots of people have rediscovered Marx and used the language of commodification. And yet, the very area in which Marx, in that insight, is proven correct, the commodification of human life of the unborn, is never mentioned. Peter Singer wrote a book on introducing Marx, Terry Eagleton too, and so many others. And yet, though they will talk about commodification of all value, they never talk about the one major principle where it is writ large, the treatment of the aborted unborn. Why is that? We live in a double culture and we interject those values. If you think that trying to find out about self-deception is about locking yourself away in a quiet room, well, to a degree it does. But if you think that you do not need preparation by understanding your culture, socio-politically and economically, you are wrong. We use our culture and its values for good or bad to define ourselves and to lie to ourselves. We will think of self-esteem in terms of worldly success, not in terms of the glory of God. In St. John's Gospel, chapter 5, Jesus is having an argument with the Pharisees, as was his wont. And he was saying to them that you read Moses, but you don't get Moses because he spoke of me. And then he said the reason why they did not have the faith to be able to read the scriptures correctly. And he said this: rather than seek the glory of God, you seek the glory of men. Rather than seek the glory of God, you seek the glory of men. In other words, you seek the status that comes from this fallen world in its corruption. Everything becomes manipulable in our world, including memory. Including memory. We might take the history of Freudian analysis. Since the 70s at least, people like Frederick Cruz and Esterson and others have shown how Freud basically falsified his data, of course. And that's become well known, widely known in fact. And yet Freud's ideas of a kind of suppression due to, or rather repression due to childhood anguish, hiding and masking so-called sexual abuse that was hidden away, that yet had to be rediscovered, started to become fundamental with other Freuds. Sybil. Sybil was a major figure in the 60s, early 70s, a best-selling book about supposedly a woman who had multiple personality disorder caused by repression of memories of her being sexually abused. Well, we know now that it was a fake. Michelle Remembers was a book in the 70s about some girl who was supposedly taken in by satanic ritual abuse, and she started to remember them by a counselor. That too was a fake. The 80s was full, as of course the 90s were, of so-called satanic ritual abuse, where suddenly people under therapy discovered I was satanically ritually abused. And the amount of injustice that came through that was horrendous. And then there was a new age form, Courage to Heal, that encouraged people, especially women, to remember that they had been abused. We manufacture memories as well when it suits us. And possibly the bizarrest example of this was a book called Remembering Satan, written in 1994, about a true story of a fellow called Lawrence Wright, whose daughters, who was a member of a fundamentalist Protestant groups, whose daughters started to claim that they started to retrieve memories of he and a whole lot of others in the towns satanically, ritually abusing them. Of course, it was ridiculous, but here's the thing. He, under counseling, started to remember that he abused them. It was a false. To what degree do we do this? To what degree do we manufacture or slightly edit these memories in our own way? In his book, Motivated Irrationality, in the Clarendon Press, Oxford, David Pears notes how we intentionally misrepresent facts to ourselves, and we are able to do so because we intentionally undermine reason. The point of all of this is this: we live in the midst of a culture that encourages us to think that everything is malleable, And because it's malleable, therefore it's good. And as it's malleable, we can create anything and everything. Even our memories, even reason is subordinate to this malleability. It is a plain fact that we can intentionally manipulate our memory, and even with the right encouragement to manufacture memory. But here's my point that I made in the first week and last week. We do so, and we do so by intentionally forgetting that we set out to do this. We can also intentionally work to undermine our own reasoning, for it is the exercise of reason that brings things to clarity. That's why, in passive and covert aggression, the major aim of it is to undermine a person so they don't know where they stand. I think I might have mentioned it last week, but in studies done of passive aggression among American school children, schoolgirls, and subsequent studies, what it shows is that in passive aggression, it destroys a person, as a couple of the girls said, from within. And we do the same to ourselves. In fact, all of us know we can do these things. All of us know we can do these things. What I'm saying is surely no surprise. We have all of us learned from a very early age to lie, and often habitually to lie. And we learn to lie to others and to ourselves. Why is it that it is not a bigger matter? Why is it that it is not a major matter? And thus, when our culture talks about that lying to ourselves and to others is a vital lie, that it is necessary for our evolution and our success and our happiness, well, that in itself is the major lie. Perhaps the biggest lie of all. No wonder that Jesus did not have faith in those around him. And yet he loves us. And he calls us to ourselves in order to find the true person that we have been created to be, that we have been called to be. As I said, it used to be, even up till 40 or 50 years ago, and one can even look at Carl Jung in this matter. For example, Carl Jung would talk about you come to who you are, you find who you are. And yet today, even Carl Jung is made to serve the idea that you can become whatever you want to be. That is a fundamental change in thinking. From the idea that you come to that which you are called to be, that which you are, to the idea that you are not in fact called to be anything definite, but that you can be whatever you like to be. So it goes from something solid to something malleable and plastic to something virtual. What is it we are created to be, that we are called to be? That is the inner journey. It's what St. Augustine painted in the Confessions. We are called to cooperate with grace. Now here's the thing. There's an incredible accent again in our culture, both in spirituality and I guess in most areas of our culture. And it's the idea of feelings. The idea of feelings, the idea of following your heart, not your head, the idea that this is corroborated by these incredible experiences that you can get, mountaintop experiences, exhilarating experiences, these kind of mystical transports. And that's why I think people look at the zealousness of converts. But the zealousness of converts is the zealousness and zeal of the young. Of the young. As I said in earlier weeks, when we look at St. John of the Cross and Mother Teresa's experiences, in point of fact, what the sign of maturity is not, in fact, that you have mountaintop experiences, but often that you have no experiences whatsoever, and yet nevertheless are obedient, and yet nevertheless continue on. That is maturity. In a sense, the miraculous is a sign of immaturity. It's a sign of the necessity to be able to persuade and lead on those who are immature, because it is the immature, the young, who in their place are appropriate, who need the miraculous, who need the incredible feelings. It's a bit like the model, I guess, of marriage, of, well, any close relationship. I guess it begins with infatuation, but very quickly that wears off, and we all know the result of depending and trying to seek infatuation again: adultery and fornication and despair. The maturity of love is, of course, that even though at times you can hate your partner, there is something deeper that carries it through. We are called, this side of the beatific vision, to slog, to climb arduously. And that accords with our very beingness, our very being. We are called to cooperate with grace. And that's why it's so easy at the beginning of a conversion. And because I suppose God's grace is such, it carries us. But as we grow a little bit older, that grace still works deeply, but not quite as immediately to our consciousness. And consequently, we find it difficult to pray. We find it difficult to do the right things. Of course, because our will has been made alive. With self-deception and trying to analyze yourself with it, it's one of the most difficult things to do. Of course it is. It's incredibly difficult. And very quickly you'll find yourself thinking about how all those others are self-deceived, and isn't it obvious? In other words, very quickly you will distract yourself. Very quickly you'll say things like, "This is too difficult, I don't have the time. I already suffer from negative self-image, this is not what I need. Oh, I have a bad memory." It's probably one of the more common ones. Well, there's a reason you have a bad memory, it's because you trained yourself to have a bad memory, and you can train yourself to not have a bad memory. "I can't reason, as I never did philosophy." As if doing philosophy teaches you to reason, one hopes it does, but you don't need philosophy to teach you to reason, though it can teach you to fine hone it. Or variations of this: "I'm not up to this, gosh, I'm just simple folk." Possibly this actually applies more to the Australian male than the female. I don't know how many times I've heard, especially maturer men in churches and elsewhere, who spend incredible amount of intellectual time doing their taxes or working on machines or looking at statistics of sport or other such things, but all of a sudden when it comes to questions of philosophy and theology, suddenly "I'm just a dumb hillbilly." This is what Walter Hilton wrote: "There is a type of exercise in which it is necessary for all of us to be engaged, and that is for a person to enter into himself so as to come to know his own soul, its strengths and weaknesses, its fairness and its foulness. In this inward evaluation, you shall come to see the honor and the dignity which the soul was intended to have by its original creation. And you shall see also the wretchedness and the mischief into which you have fallen because of sin. There is a type of exercise in which it is necessary for all of us to be engaged. It's an exercise all of us can do, all of us, bar none here. For a person to enter into themselves so as to come to know their own soul, the strengths, weaknesses, fairness and foulness. And in this inward evaluation, you shall come to see the honour and dignity which a soul was intended to have by its original creation. And you shall see also the wretchedness and mischief into which you have fallen because of sin. You will see the unhappiness you create for yourself. And then Hilton goes on to write, when love opens the inner eye of the soul, then the soul begins to be truly meek. In the sight of God, it sees and is conscious of itself as it actually is. It is to see the presence of God as the gift of God. And Walter Hilton then goes on to write, there is no other gift of God in which he is both the giver and the gift, except this gift of love. There is no other gift of God in which he is both giver and gift, except this gift of love. And this brings us back to the question then of fear. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 26, this has to do with the first appearance of God on Mount Sinai. And the Israelites have just come out of Egypt, gone to the Exodus, and they're already whinging, wanting to go home. And they're coming to Mount Sinai, and God says there must be a three-day preparation for them. And they prepare, and then on Mount Sinai, they can see this incredible, fearful theophany of dark cloud and lightning and thunder and earthquake. And they're told, don't you even go near the mountain, don't even touch it. To which they basically respond, you don't have to tell us that. They don't want to go anywhere near it. And they say to Moses, you go and talk to God for us. Basically, we'll stay right over there. And Moses then tries to help them to see what's going on. And he says this to them, do not fear. For God has come to prove you, so that the fear of him may be before you, so that you will not sin. Somewhat of a paradox there. Do not fear, for God has come to prove you, so that the fear of God will be before you, in order that you will not sin. It's as the author of Hebrews said, it's like a parent with their child. You have to inculcate fear at times, or your child is going to run out into the road and get killed. A true lover does not sit back and see their beloved destroy themselves. Again, I don't know how many times I've heard people say in charity, we're not out to change these people. Well, I for one will not give any of my money to those charities. I see no validity or credence in giving money to allow alcoholics or drug addicts or anyone else continue to destroy their life. A true person who loves someone wants the best for that person. Does not want to see them kill themselves. Does not want to see them destroy themselves. And will do just about anything to stop them doing that. And that's God. And that's why fear and trembling are so absolutely necessary. Wisdom begins with the fear of God. It proceeds through fear and trembling to salvation. But its end is love, where gift and giver are one and the same. We began this series on anthropology, and I hope by now it's clear why I did so. Because when we're talking about self-deception, we are talking certainly about, let's say, the little contents of self-deception, but fundamentally what we're talking about in self-deception is the wrong concept of the self. Is the construct of the self that you present to yourself that may be good, may be bad, but unfortunately, especially today, is full of interjected values of our modern global capital consumer economy. And that's why I began with the image of God in Genesis and pointed out how the author of Genesis, by putting those two apparently contradictory accounts, was not showing a contradiction, but showing you what the fall looked like. Recall the first chapter of Genesis, remember? Everything is created good, tov. And when humanity is created, humanity is created as a communion of male and female, as a plural, singular, plural. But in the second account, there's a subtle change. And remember, only Adam is created. And it is said of Adam, and this before the fall, it is not good for man to be alone. What the author of Genesis had told us there is what not goodness looks like. Being, all creation is per se good, being created by a good God. And yet there is evil. And as I pointed out in the first week, as the fathers pointed out, evil, sin, is nothing in itself. It's a falling away from being. It's a falling into non-being, a state of less than being. And what the author of Genesis has pointed out to us by that contrast is he's told you what not good looks like, what not being looks like. And what it looks like is loneliness, is alienation, is fragmented communion. And as I pointed out, the idea of the autonomous individual has therefore been with us since the fall, but certainly in the modern period, it's become dominant, such that it informs liberal progressivism today, and liberal progressivism is merely the cultural expression of modern capitalism, consumerism. The two historically and philosophically go together, even though liberal progressivists will say they oppose capitalism at every turn, their actions support it. Fundamental to liberal progressivism is the notion of the autonomous individual. It's what legitimizes abortion, euthanasia, the whole culture of death. And it's what we introject when we make conscience to be merely our own voice, as we saw last week. But all of this is to do violence against ourselves, is to make ourselves fundamentally lonely, alienated, fragmented. As we saw St. Paul in Romans chapter 7, that fracture that runs through all creation since the fall runs right in here. We are at war against ourselves, and our self-deception is one of our worst weapons against us, against ourselves. In pride, we deceive ourselves into thinking that we do not need mediation of others, that we can have everything directly, immediately, and for ourselves, that we can be God. As I pointed out last week, when you look at works like Neil Walsh's Conversations with God that came out in the 90s, Eckhart Tolle's works, The Secret, and so on and so forth, what they all say is, you are God. Yeah, you shall be as God. In other words, the autonomous individual becomes so puffed up in pride, it says, I am the universe, I am everything, I am God. G.K. Chesterton observed that it was wrong to call a madman cracked. This is back in the 20s, and it was a phrase even up into the 60s and 70s that was used as a kind of pejorative to describe someone who is mad, to call them cracked. Chesterton observed that it was in fact wrong to call a madman cracked, or we might say out of his mind, because a madman is quite the reverse. As Chesterton pointed out, a madman is too tightly contained. The universe fits too snugly in their head. And thus, a madman needs to be broken open in order for the air to get in. We need to be broken open. And that's what God does to us, insofar as we can handle it. But we are meant to be broken in order so that we can see what it is we are meant to truly be. In love and grace, this is what Jesus Christ sets out to do. For though it is painful, the goal is wonderful. As St. Paul puts it in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 4 to 7, I paraphrase, by reasons of God's great love for us, He made us alive with Christ. He raised us with Christ so that He might show us the incomparable riches of His grace. In Ephesians 3:18, in order that we might know the love of Christ, which surpasses all knowledge, and be filled with all the fullness of God. That is the goal, to be filled with all the fullness of God. And thus in Romans chapter 8, 39, as St. Paul says, there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord. And I think when you put all the biblical view of what it is we are called to be, when you look at the history and the writings of the church fathers and mystics, when you look at the way Dante describes the beatific vision, it is that we are called to be. As C.S. Lewis puts it, if we as Christians could see ourselves at the beatific vision, we would probably be tempted to fall down and worship us because of that incredible glory that comes through God's grace. That is how great we are called to be. And in self-deception, we cut ourselves off from that. We contain ourselves within our own narrow confines and we pretend that's the world and that's God and that's us. To understand that we are called to be filled with all the fullness of God and that nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord, that is to have true self-esteem.
That was a talk by Dr. Robert Tilley entitled The Bible and Self-Analysis, Mystical Humility and Identifying the Signs of Self-Deception. This was the third and final talk of Dr. Robert Tilley's series, The Bible and the Mystery of Self-Deception, which was presented at the Catholic Institute of Sydney. For more talks, visit cradio.org.au.